Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Fulton Lewis, Jr., speaking from the studios of WHK in Cleveland, Ohio. After spending the better part of the weekend trying to sound out election trends here in Ohio and in West Virginia and Michigan. I told you Friday evening from New York that I'd give you a report on that this evening, but frankly, my material is not quite finished. There still are some people I want to see. And anyway, I have some news for you this evening that I think will be far more interesting to you, far more immediate. So let's put off the politics, if you say so, until tomorrow evening or Wednesday. You may recall that on Friday evening I told you that the Special Commission of American Military Observers, which has been in England for more than a month, getting a first-hand picture of the German attack on Great Britain, had just arrived in New York by a Pan-American clipper and was on its way immediately to Washington to report to the President. The commission was made up of the picked brains of the Army, and it was headed by Major General George V. Strong, a wiry, slender little gentleman who holds the vitally important job of Chief of the War Plans Division of the Army. That is the branch of the Army that plans all strategy, tactics, the brains of the fighting force, in other words. And this is one of the few times in all history that any Army has had the opportunity that this commission has had on this occasion. So it occurred to me that you might find it worthwhile if I were to interview General Strong for you and to get a bit of cold, hard fact as to what really is the situation in England at the present time. So as soon as the General got back to Washington, I spent nearly 3 hours with him at his home, asking every question I could think of, and so here we go on the picture as he gave it to me. In the first place, by way of explanation, he told me that he actually was on the fighting front all the time he was in England. He and the other members of the American military delegation had military aides assigned to them by the British Army, aides who took them wherever they wanted to go, whenever they wanted to go there, inspecting the most secret installations of defense equipment here, there, and everywhere, and the delegation was actually in London as late as last Wednesday night. I asked General Strong what the physical damage has been to London so far, whether it's a smoldering mass of ruins, just a shambles, as you might well imagine from some of the more sensational accounts which we hear and read every day. By way of getting it a little more vividly and a little more tangible in terms, I asked him to apply the damage that has been done in London to some typical American city, which everyone is familiar with, the city of Washington, for example, and he did so. He said, suppose the capital in Washington is Westminster Abbey, and the White House, which is 16 blocks up Pennsylvania Avenue, is Buckingham Palace. Let's take an automobile ride from the Capitol to the White House and see what damage has been done. To begin with, he said, there's a bomb crater off to one side of the Capitol Plaza. The hole is perhaps 25 feet across and 15 feet deep. Stakes have been driven around the pavement with a rope to warn absent-minded automobiles not to drive into it. And you get around to the other front of the White House, the one that looks up Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House, where you're headed, of course, there's another crater at the foot of the lawn about the same size. Now, as you go from the Capitol up Pennsylvania Avenue, you pass First Street, Second Street, and then on the corner of Third Street, you find the top of two stories on one corner of a building have blown off, but the filling station on the street level of that building is still operating just as though nothing were wrong. When you come to Sixth Street, you find one fairly large office building that has been hit directly by three or four bombs all at once, and that is just a pile of bricks and mortar. It may occupy as much as a 16th of the entire city block. From there up 7th Street and on past 8th Street, there will be no sign of damage at all. But in the next block, all of the glass will be broken out of shop windows from a bomb that has dropped in the street, but the hole in the street already will have been filled up and repaved over so that you can hardly tell where it happened. That is the block between 9th and 10th, off to the side, a little way up 12th Street, we'll say. When you get there, you'll see several stores, the little one-story shops of poor construction, which have been gutted by fire. Across the parkway at 14th Street, across the wide lawn there, some of the fancy stonework will have been blown off the eaves of the Commerce Department building, and perhaps the top two stories on one side of that building will be blasted hollow over an area of perhaps four or five or six office rooms. There'll be no damage at all to the Treasury Department, perhaps, which fills the space between 15th Street and the White House. So far as the White House itself is concerned, there may be a couple of crater holes in the lawn. There's a hole in the roof where a dead bomb has come through and has landed in the President's bathtub. You know one did come through and land in the King's bathtub. He said that when you get away from the downtown section into the residential districts, the damage is considerably less, particularly where the houses are set apart from one another. In poorer sections, where the houses are close together, actually adjoining each other, with a lot of frame construction, You find here and there a full block that has been wiped out by fire. In some one or two cases, there may be two or three or even more blocks if the fire got out of control or happened to occur on a very busy night. The chief damage, however, is where the glass has been blown out of windows, and the general said it really is a boom time for the glaziers because they're busy all the time. He said one little tailor shop downtown has just replaced his show window for the third time in 2 weeks. I asked him whether there's any difficulty in getting glass to replace that is broken, and he said there doesn't seem to be. The glass mills are turning it out as fast as the German bombs can make business for them, and the glaziers themselves seem to be able to keep up with the pace pretty well putting it in. For a day or so, a merchant will have a show window covered with cloth or perhaps transparent paper, but he'll have a sign which says, business as usual. About the fires, General Strong said that they have done more damage than the bombs have themselves. He said that one night, the worst night of the entire German attack on London, he stood in the window of his hotel room and could see the glare of 9 different fires in various parts of the city. I might add that he said the London Fire Department, in the last 2 weeks, has more than paid for every penny that was ever spent on it for the last 100 years. He said there's one hospital in the city at which one whole wing has been reduced to absolute ruins. Apparently, it was struck almost simultaneously by about 5 or 6 bombs. And his guess was that some German bomber overhead had been attacked by defensive planes of the Royal Air Force, had become frightened. The pilot had dumped his entire load of bombs in order to lighten the ship and make a getaway, and it was just tragedy that the bombs happened to fall on a hospital. Now, you doubtless have seen pictures of these various sites, buildings in ruins, blazing fires. But, of course, those are the only things that photographers take pictures of. There is no news interest in taking pictures of the buildings that are not injured. And when you take pictures of the ones that are injured, you always set up your camera so that it will do the most efficient job possible of showing the damage. I know that. As a local newspaper reporter years ago, I pointed out the best angle from which to shoot many a picture to many a news photographer. The point is that seeing these pictures of total damage day after day, we sometimes drift into the idea, perhaps, that all of London looks that way. There is never any clue as to how extensive this damage is in proportion. So in order to get an answer to that puzzle, I asked General Strong what part of all the buildings in London, in his opinion, have been damaged in these German air attacks. Damage of any kind at all, even down to mere breaking of windows. And his reply was something less than 1%. Now, that would seem to indicate from the amount of air attack that has been made on London in these last 3, 4, 5 weeks that the German bombing operations are not nearly as efficient as they've been advertised. So I asked the general what sort of success that German air raider force has had in knocking out the nerve centers of British production, which, after all, are the targets at which they're shooting: airplane factories, munition factories, railroad stations, military supply depots, all sorts of definite targets. After all, planes are not merely sent over from Germany to just drop bombs indiscriminately on London with a capital L. You'll never get very far in any war on that basis. And the general's answer was that the bombing has been very inefficient and very ineffective from that point of view. He said that the anti-aircraft batteries on the ground have accounted for only about 3% of the planes brought down so far, but they have forced the German planes to stay at a height of about 30,000 feet. That's way up in the air. And if they get much below that, the ground batteries can be and are highly effective. At that altitude, however, bombing is just a hit-and-miss operation. He said it's little more than guesswork, and the effective damage on real targets, for that reason, has been very small. He said there are occasions, of course, when Lady Luck rides the shoulder of a German pilot. And he told me about one occasion when a bomb hit one corner of the train shed of a London station. Then a split second later, another bomb hit the other corner. It was something that no pilot could have repeated if he'd tried a million times, but Lady Luck did it for him this time. The roof toppled over, and an immense steel truss of the roof fell squarely across the tracks leading into that station. It took men with acetylene torches several days to cut up the metal and get rid of it so as to let the trains operate through the station again. But he said, that's very rare indeed. He said the damage that's been done to key industries and vital production plants is very small indeed, and for the most part, entirely accidental. I then asked General Strong, what about life in London, whether it's a deserted and demoralized city with hundreds, with all of the people huddling day after day in houses with closed shutters? He said that, on the contrary, life goes on very much as usual. Nurses take the children out into the parks in the afternoon to play. Ladies and gentlemen on horseback still ride in the morning and afternoon along Rotten Row. The corner tailor and the baker shop and all the rest of the stores are still doing regular business at the old stand. Taxi cabs, streetcars, omnibuses, subways still function as usual. He said that in his hotel, there were several mornings when the waiter told him the bread man had failed to arrive, so he'd have to take toast made from last night's bread instead of fresh rolls for breakfast. Several times, the morning paper failed to arrive until noon. A large part of the population, he said, has reached the point of being a little annoyed about losing sleep at air raid sirens being sounded so frequently through the night, but otherwise, he said, everything is just about routine. During the daytime, according to the general, no one pays very much attention to the air raid sirens when they are sounded. A few extremely timid souls will get to cover. If and when the sound of bursting bombs begins to disrupt the air, a few more will go to cover, but almost everyone still would remain on the streets even then. He said that the time that they really flock to cover, and all of them do so, is when the aircraft batteries begin to fire, because he said the falling fragments of aircraft shells, anti-aircraft shells, have proven to be the most dangerous of all to the rank-and-file population. Now, I see that my time is just about up, which seems too bad because there's a great deal of further material, which I got from General Strong for you in this interview. What chance Germany has of crossing the English Channel for a land invasion, how long the war is likely to last, who's likely to win, whether Germany and England really have been able to obtain our secret bomb site, what sort of a job the Royal Air Force of the British Army really is doing. There are numerous angles of that kind on which he talked very frankly. I don't know whether you're interested in them, so if so, I would be very glad to devote part of the program tomorrow evening to clear them up. On the other hand, if you're not interested, I certainly don't want to bore you in case you'd prefer hearing nothing but domestic news. So let's leave it this way. If you want me to give you the rest of this interview in part of my time tomorrow evening, send a telegram to Station WOL in Washington in my name. If enough of them arrive there by noon tomorrow, we'll do it. Otherwise, we'll just stick to regular routine. Just send it to me in care of Station WOL in Washington. But that's the top of the news as it looks to me, ladies and gentlemen, or rather to General Strong. Until tomorrow evening from Washington, good night.
You have been listening to Fulton Lewis, Jr., Mutual's nightly news reporter on the national scene, who comes to you each evening, Monday through Friday, at the same time. Tonight, Mr. Lewis spoke from the studios of WHK and WCLE in Cleveland, Ohio. Broadcasting System.